Fred Holmquist.
I'm a counselor on Lilly, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and my life is very unmanageable. The topic of this morning's lecture is the first step of the AA program. Voila. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I don't want any of you whose chemical of choice happens to be something other than alcohol to feel left out of our discussion this morning. The powerlessness and unmanageability referred to in this step are just as real for the person chemically dependent to the mood-altering substances that are smoked, such as marijuana and hashish, opium, to the mood-altering substances that are taken in pill form, such as Valium, Librium, codeine, to the mood-altering substances that we snort into our nostrils, like cocaine, and to the chemicals that we inject into our veins, like crystal or heroin. We all meet on common ground here at Hazelden, powerless over our particular chemical of choice and reeling from the recent experiences of our unmanageable lives. The longest of journeys begins with a single first step, as does beginning to live life again, chemically free and sober. We, as alcoholics and chemically dependent people, are most fortunate to live in this era that we do, a time in which millions of others like ourselves are finding sobriety through the 12 steps of the AA program. In discussing this first step of our journey this morning, I'll be drawing from my own personal experiences and from the experiences that have been passed on through others who have gone before us in AA. I'd like to discuss three major points in the first step. The first one would be simply, we admitted. Just exactly what does that mean to me and my chemical problem right now? I've admitted that I've got a problem. What else is involved? I've admitted a lot of things, and that's never helped me before. Point number two, that we were powerless over alcohol. Powerless, I've stopped drinking lots of times. If I'm powerless, what hope is there? Isn't that kind of a strong word to use? And the third point, that our lives had become unmanageable. Unmanageable. I've got a responsible job, a healthy family, I pay my bills on time, and I drove to treatment in my own car. The only time I'm unmanageable is when I'm drunk. Yeah, my life's unmanageable, but isn't everybody's? Let's begin with the first point. We admit it. Some of you have stated for a period of time that you are alcoholic or chemically dependent. Statements such as, my name is John Doe and I'm an alcoholic, or I guess I'm an alcoholic, or I must be an alcoholic, are heard on all of the rehabilitation units here at Hazelden every day. This is the beginning. We wind up on a drunk farm, and everyone else in the circle is saying that they're alcoholic, and now it's my turn. And sure, I've been drinking a lot lately, and my spouse is concerned, and the family wants me to do something about my drinking, and life has been miserable, but God, an alcoholic? One of the most predominant symptoms of the disease of alcoholism is denial. The treatment process here at Hazelden is designed to assist us in recognizing this denial that all of us, to some degree, experience. From the experience of others who have followed the steps of the AA program, a process of surrender is described when discussing what happens when we admitted in the first step. In surrendering, a portion of the denial is broken through. Surrendering has always meant to me simply that the fighting is over. The conflict has stopped. In the first step, admitting to the reality of our lives our alcoholism or our dependency on chemicals, we stop fighting the fact that we no longer are social drinkers or occasional recreational users, and that all of the headaches and the hangovers and the disappointments and the collapsed veins and the broken promises need not be a part of our lives any longer. I can't tell you how admitting we were powerless over alcohol becomes surrendering to that fact. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous states that it is necessary that we, quote, fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. When I was in treatment, I was very eager to grasp the program, and I attacked the reading assignments that I was given with the same zeal that I used to attack a six-pack of beer. I read and reread the literature presented on the first step and learned that surrender wasn't something that would happen to me by doing just that, by understanding it, by knowing what it was all about up here. It was a deeper emotional process that was part of a subconscious change that I could not will to happen, like learning math tables or memorizing a law in physics. What I heard from my counselors at the time was, easy does it. Slow down a little bit. It doesn't happen overnight for everyone. And that was good advice for me, because I really can't go back to a particular point in my recovery process to date and say, well, up until here I was holding on, but I surrendered here and it's been great since. What I do know is that it took a long time. I still continue to do it during treatment, and since, I've come to accept my alcoholism as a fact. It's a reality in my life today. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, a psychiatrist who has done studies on the attitudes of death and dying and terminal illness and written several books and pamphlets on that subject, describes certain stages that a terminally ill patient undergoes in accepting or surrendering to death, which is inevitable in their lives. These same stages can be used to describe how an alcoholic or a chemically dependent person comes to surrender and accept their chronic disease. I have experienced these stages in my alcoholism. The first stage that she describes is denial. We simply deny the fact that it's going on. As applied to the alcoholic or chemically dependent person, examples of this stage are not difficult to find. My favorite is the statement that I heard often while working in a detox facility, and one that I recall making myself when drunk. It could be a person who had soiled their pants because they were so intoxicated or thrown up or whatever, but they'd look me straight in the eye and say, "I'm not drunk, you're drunk." Much of the denial that we experience isn't that obvious. It's a lot more subtle. We can fool ourselves. We can fool ourselves into drinking way beyond the point, continuing to use past the point that alcohol and chemicals have really affected our lives and started to cause problems. The second stage she describes is anger. We as alcoholics and chemically dependent people resent the fact that we can't drink or use like other people. The anger that I experienced was mostly directed at myself in the morning when I woke up and began that painful process of piecing together maybe where I was, what I'd done, how I'd gotten there. Why was I doing this? Why can't I stop? I just continue to do this and to do this and to do this. And it really, I had a difficult problem being with myself because of that. After anger comes the bargaining stage. We bargain with ourselves. Well, I'll only drink wine, or I'll only drink beer, and only on the weekends, or I'll only use Valium. I really won't use any sleepers. We bargain with others. This is the last time. I promise it won't happen again. Just give me this one last chance. The next stage that is described is the depression stage. when denying becomes absurd, and anger becomes only more self-defeating, and bargaining gets us nowhere any longer, we've lost our bargaining power, at this point, when the reality of our powerlessness becomes overwhelming, a depression is felt that draws us into ourselves and away from help. With the help of others in Alcoholics Anonymous and others going through the same treatment process, the final stage of surrender can be reached. That stage is acceptance, as the terminal patient can face death with calm and the peace of acceptance, so can the alcoholic and chemically dependent person face the process of recovery, and in particular, life without alcohol or chemicals. The alternative at this point need not be death. We're really fortunate in that sense, in this model. Rather, the alternative is life, the kind of life that so many people this moment are living in AA. Well, what are we surrendering to and accepting? Brings us to the second point this morning. Powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The second point of the first step that we need to come to grips with is what our relationship with alcohol has come to. Again, let me point out that the powerlessness that the first step refers to all mood-altering substances as well as alcohol. The big book, again, of Alcoholics Anonymous, refers to powerlessness as, quote, with hardly an exception, absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. And that means something a little bit different to each of us, but I think it's a strong message. My understanding of powerlessness comes from that statement. Left to my own devices, I will use alcohol. If I'm not plugged into some power outside of myself, I will eventually use alcohol or something mood-altering. I've proved this to myself many, many times in attempting to sober up on my own terms and on my own ground. Countless times, I set out to turn over a new leaf and not go out and get drunk, as I found myself doing with great frequency. Countless times, I'd go for several days, sometimes weeks. I have several 4-month periods of sobriety in my lifetime, only to find myself rewarding me with just a few beers because I'd done so well and I'd started to feel so good. And then again, that beer or two would turn into another drunken nightmare, usually worse than the last one, and soon I'd be at the bottom looking up again. Powerless over alcohol. Against my will, against my promises, and because of my disease of alcoholism, I had lost the ability to drink in a manner that didn't cause me harm. Within each of us are all of the examples of how alcohol and drugs have ruled our lives. Once denial is recognized and begun to be dealt with, the stories of powerlessness in each of our lives pour out, going back further and further and becoming more subtle and subtle into our drinking and using histories. From my experience at the detox facility where I worked comes an example of powerlessness, the potential of which is in all of us here. This particular alcoholic had, over a period of 3 years, been admitted to detox in excess of 100 times. And for the period of time that I worked there, his longest sober time outside of the facility was 8 hours. He would leave in the morning after a 72-hour stay, or longer if he was having a particularly difficult withdrawal, and return quite drunk, usually 4 to 6 hours later that same afternoon. We'd tell the people coming on the next shift, this individual left this morning, so you'll have an admit probably 3 or 4 this afternoon. He had lost the ability to remain sober for any length of time on his own. One of the most dramatic examples of powerlessness in my own life was an unscheduled trip I took by airplane to another city. It was a typical day for me. I lived outside of town on a farm, and I'd gone in to do my wash. And while clothes were in the washer, I'd go over to my favorite tavern and drink, and then go back and put them in the dryer and go back and drink. I met a gentleman at the bar who said he was a pilot for Pan Am, and seemed like kind of an interesting person. We began to drink together. Continued to get pretty drunk, and he said, "Say, I've got a friend who's got a cabin on a lake up outside of Spokane, Washington. We could fly up there, have a great time." Sounded like a wonderful idea at the time. So we charged a couple of tickets on my credit card, money that I didn't have, and flew up to Spokane. When we got there, the first thing we did was check into the bar to have a few drinks. And at that time, I got concerned about getting my money back for the plane ticket. So I said, "Say, do you suppose I could get the money for the plane ticket?" Well, he got real angry and threw the money on the bar and walked away. I could never find him. I was just at that point of being drunk where I maybe looked okay, but as soon as I opened my mouth, I really gave it away. I had no place to stay, no transportation. I checked into a motel, and the next morning I just remembered everything that I had to do the next day back in the other city where I wasn't. I had an appointment for full mouth x-rays because I was having some special gum work done at the University of Washington. I hadn't brought with me my diabetes medication, and I'd left many thousands of dollars of camera equipment left in my unlocked car in the parking lot back in Walla Walla. So here it was for me, a simple afternoon of doing my clothes turned into a totally unmanageable situation where I endangered my health, my financial status, and delayed some work that needed to be done on my mouth. The third point, that's unmanageability for me. That's kind of one of my classic examples. The third point of our discussion this morning is unmanageability. There is the obvious unmanageable behavior that we experience as a result of our powerlessness over chemicals, such as the example I just cited. There are also the areas of sober unmanageability that are created by the long period of time during which we deal with our emotions by losing them in a drunken haze or covering them up in a drug-induced euphoria. I had few healthy methods of dealing with the anger and resentments and fear, all of the other natural feelings that are a part of my being human, of my human condition. Another type of unmanageability is our inability to control others around us, even though we make constant efforts to do so. The first and most obvious type of unmanageability is that caused by our drinking and using. The constant use of alcohol or our drug of choice creates intoxicated behavior. The unscheduled trip out of town, the meal that just didn't get prepared, the appointments that were forgotten, the unkind and untrue comments that were made, the remorse we suffered the morning after. Again, drawing from my detox experience, the most startling evidence of an unmanageable life I witnessed was a case of alcoholic hallucinosis, a condition found in some people during withdrawal from alcohol after a particularly extended and heavy period of use. This gentleman required constant attention through this episode of hallucination so that he wouldn't harm himself or others. As I sat next to him, and he was lying in bed, he rose up and very carefully attempted to open each one of the little bricks in the wall as if it was a small door. And in his continuing search for something to drink, he very carefully lifted each of his shoes individually from the floor, and drank slowly and carefully from the top of the heel, holding it at the end to get the very last drop. Some kind of imaginary liquid. It did seem to satisfy him, and he slept comfortably for the next 2 or 3 hours. A less dramatic example of unmanageability comes from the period in my life when I was staying drunk pretty much around the clock. I hadn't emptied the garbage in my apartment for about 2 or 3 weeks, and when I did, I put them in 3 of those real big plastic garbage bags and put them in my car, planning to drop them off at a supermarket or a gas station that had the big garbage cans. It was midsummer in Minneapolis, and my car stayed locked in a parking lot in southeast Minneapolis all during the day. After several weeks, nature took its normal course on breaking down the organic part of the garbage, and it was this horrendous, smell in the car that I continued to live with. I just kind of drive with my head out the window sometimes at first. And it didn't get cleaned up until a friend of mine asked to borrow my car. And she took care of it, fortunately. I don't have the car, but I'm sure it still stinks. That's, again, is unmanageability. Again, as we surrender and accept our powerlessness and unmanageability, we are able to see the many examples of how our lives are becoming more and more difficult to manage, that we are failing to maintain responsibility, even to ourselves, to others, to our jobs, in all areas of our lives. Much of our unmanageable behavior occurs when we're not drinking or using. Most of the pain I suffered in my alcoholism has been when I was sober. Acting from our emotions is the source of most of our unmanageable sober behavior. To me, this is the I want what I want when I want it statement. A good example of sober unmanageability is cited by a former Hazelden counselor. He relates the story of a young sailor he knew who, angered by another man cheating at a craft game, lashed out with a knife and stabbed him and killed him. He was court-martialed and was put to death for that act. So essentially, he lost his own life as a result of his unmanageable emotions. There wasn't any chemicals or alcohol involved in that particular situation. The consequences of sober unmanageability suffered by most alcoholics and chemically dependent people are not as obvious, but can be just as lethal. For example, when escape from our emotional pain leads to drunken unmanageability, which is involved in at least half of the many, many thousands of fatal automobile accidents that occur in the United States. Another aspect of alcoholic unmanageability is the notion we get that we can control the actions, thoughts, and feelings of those around us. We have needed the approval of others to feel good about ourselves for a large part of our lives. In this search for good feelings, we've spent much of our life's energy attempting to manipulate people into liking and accepting us. As our alcoholism, powerlessness, progressed and our lives became more unmanageable, we could no longer get the approval of any significant other people in our lives. This has been the most devastating experience in my recovery process to date. To understand and accept that I am responsible for my own feelings and that my need to control others causes self-defeating and harmful emotional behavior, which is sober unmanageability. Like my alcoholism and powerlessness, my sober unmanageability is forever. It's a part of my living experience, a part of my particular human condition. The more I surrender to and accept the fact, the more free I become to recognize my unmanageable behavior and to deal with it in the healthy ways as outlined in the rest of the steps suggested for recovery in the AA program. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Today I've discussed how this first step of the AA program, as suggested for recovery from the disease of alcoholism, applies to all other mood-altering chemicals as well as alcohol. That there are millions of people finding sobriety through this program today. That the phrase, "we admitted," goes beyond a simple statement of powerlessness and unmanageability. That we break through denial by surrendering to our disease so that we can stop fighting within ourselves, and acceptance follows, providing a calm, enabling us to see more clearly our situation. I talked about powerlessness, our inability to control our drinking and using, or to predict when we will stop or start. I discussed unmanageability from three directions: drunken unmanageability, sober unmanageability with regard to our emotions and how we are controlled by them, and the unmanageability that we experience when we attempt to control others in our lives. Initial exposure to the first step can sound negative, defeating, weak-willed, and make us full of despair. But as has been found by those going before us in the AA program, this step points out our humanness and our limitations, qualities that we deny within ourselves. I'd like to close this lecture today paraphrasing the final paragraph of a chapter in one of my Bibles. It's a book entitled Search for Serenity by Louis Presnon. It's from the chapter entitled Why Don't They Get Well? Quote, "This is a decision that only we can make, the people who are involved. No one can make it for us. No one will push us into it. It is our decision to make. If we do not make it, the universe will batter us against the hard wall of our own frustrations. We will be beaten senseless by emotional pressures of our own creating. Our problems will continue with us, unabated, while the years roll along, bringing us less and less vitality with which to cope with realities. The universe leaves us no choice at this point. We can hit bottom and grow, or we can hang on to our little pretenses and decay." Unquote. The decision is ours. AA works. It starts with the first step. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you once again. Once again, my name is Damien McElrath, and I've been at Hazelden for 2.5 years, working on the units and then working in administration. And as I told you last evening, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I've been asked to lecture this morning on Second Step. I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The steps, as you know at Hazelden, are an important part of our lives. And we go through the 12 steps once, and then we repeat the first 5 steps because they're the more important ones for us here and later on. There's a process in the steps. You always want to keep that in mind. The process is the admission, the belief, the decision, and the action. That's what we hope takes place here in the course of the 30 days that we're present. And once again, it's a process. It's not like we get one of the steps, the first step, and admit that, and then move on and take care of the second step and then the third step. It's a process just like our life is a process. We move, and we might go back a little bit to get another insight as to what the admission meant, and then we move on, decide. We understand a little bit what the surrender is in the decision, constantly taking action in the third, fourth to the 12th step. So we have to keep that in mind because it's not a static thing. It's always movement, process. That's our lives. Now, the second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And in some respects, that step has already been taken apart for you. You know what the terms mean. What I'd like to try to do this morning is to translate that step into concrete action. You know, what does it mean in our life here at Hazelden, and what does it mean in terms of our life outside? What I'd like to do is show you how the wisdom, if you will, of humanity is contained in the steps, and particularly the second step this morning. So what I want to do is base the step on our own experience. Okay, where are we in life? And what does that experience tell us in terms of that second step so that we can really make it a part of our gut? Where are we in life? And then where are we at Hazelden? And then this translation also deals in terms of the group process and the trust and the risk that we take as we deal with other people. Power greater than ourselves. I cannot do it alone. Okay? Therefore, I need somebody to help me. And to make that decision and to decide is a great step for us. Okay. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is ask you and ask myself, where are we in life? Our life process. And the second step can be translated into a phrase that has made a great impact upon myself. Our journey through life is a community affair. Someone has to say, I will be with you. Our journey through life is a community affair. Someone has to say, I will be with you. So we're asking the question, where are we in life? And then we're asking the question, where are we in our passage through Hazelden? Now, this is not a big psychological study. We all know about the book, the passages, and so forth. It's simply our understanding of the life process. Okay, where are we in life? Well, we could be from 0 to 12. Anybody here at that stage? Okay. All right, that's the period of childhood. And these divisions are purely arbitrary, as you'll see in a moment, okay? Childhood. And then 12 to 20, what they call a period of adolescence. Anybody here? Okay. I thought I saw a 50-year-old guy put his hand up. 20 to about 30, we'll call that adulthood, but it's first adulthood, okay? Who's in that period? Okay. All right, after this, you don't have to reveal yourselves anymore, okay? 30 to about 55, we'll say, is the period of second adulthood. And then 55 to 100. Now, once again, I repeat that it's a purely arbitrary decision, okay? 55 to 100 are the golden years, all right? Now, I just moved that up here because I used to put it at 50 until I turned 50. Okay. So the golden years. All right, now I just want to pick out one thing from that whole experience for all of us, all right? There's a tension that goes on in all of those periods. And it's the tension between someone with me as opposed to going it alone. And that's second step. We're not too concerned at this point, but in some respects, you could see that also parents are with children, or in some cases, the children have to go it alone. Breakup of marriages or orphans. Okay. So that tension is there. Mind you, I'm only picking out one aspect of the whole thing. The period of adolescence is really a tough time because there's a separation from parents and a tendency to associate with peers, so that there's a role confusion going on at this time. Moving away from parents and associating with peers, there's the search for identity. And it's a tough struggle because we have a tendency to look for it in peer group, you see, and not really find it where it should be found, someone definitely with me for the rest of my life. Okay, a search for identity here. Okay, 20 to 30, this tension comes about. We seek intimacy with one person. Okay, so someone is with me. Or isolation. That rugged individualism that I spoke about last evening controls this person. Even if there is a marriage, there's a problem. Second adulthood, what happens is there's a sense of generativity. Okay, so we look beyond the immediate person that we've associated with in terms of begetting children or the neighborhood or the country, community, the world at large. So there's a sense of care for a larger community than just the one that I've isolated for myself. So it's a generativity, as opposed to what takes place here for a lot of people, self-absorption. And we see that so many times, and even in families where the wife or either spouse is taken up with, say, the search for rank or position, so that it becomes a self-absorbing, self-defeating thing. And that real continuity of someone with me is lost here or destroyed. Okay. In these golden years, it's hard to put everything together. You know, I'm at my start at 60. In fact, they speak about three phases of adulthood now, but whatever. Something takes place here so that wisdom accrues or despair. Person, for example, having gone through this these phases, someone with me looks back over life and sees that all the relationships and all the changes and all the vicissitudes have a meaning. So there's a meaning for it, and says it's good. And that person begins to get wisdom, and wisdom is simply the sense of the ability to integrate, to have a sanity or a wholeness about what life is about. Or a person who's been self-absorbed and isolated and going it alone looks back over life and things seem to disintegrate. There's no ability to see a wholeness about it. All the relationships and vicissitudes and changes of life have no meaning. And so despair sets in. Disintegration. There's no meaning to it at all. Okay. The only thing that I want to bring, we, all of us here, are somewhere in this life process. This is our journey through life. And a lot of things are happening to us. The only thing that I'm isolating is this tension between going it alone and someone with me. And that's the wisdom of our own human nature. And it's the wisdom that's built into the second step. All right. As we go through the journey, we are also in a passage. And the passage is the passage through Hazelden. And that's divided into perhaps 4 weeks. And again, just as we are in different stages here, so we're in different stages. Who's in their first week? Okay. Who's in their last week? Okay, we're about evenly divided. And I'd like to just look at this first week here and see what it means in terms of someone with me, in terms of second step. Say the first 8 days. What are some of your feelings now? What were some of your feelings when you first arrived here? Fear. Feelings. Okay, this gentleman said, fear. Fear, anxiety. That's a state. Okay.
Guilt.
Yeah, guilt. Guilty feelings. Resentment. Okay, that comes out. Who said hope? Okay, did you really feel hopeful when you first arrived? Like a relief.
Anger.
Yeah. Anger and resentment. Don't forget they're both two sides of the same coin, okay? As you go through group, a lot of anger. Don't be afraid to admit it.
Shame.
Shame and guilt, okay. Somebody said something back there. Yeah, confusion. Denial. Okay. So what we have there are a lot of feelings. I know we're on tape right now, but I want to relate to you something that was kind of humorous. They might cut it out later on, we'll see. Someone said, got all of these things out, and someone said, horniness. And I said, well, yeah, I guess that's a very important feeling. And I said, I really don't know how to deal with that at this particular lecture. And I said, we'll have a special one on that with pictures and films and so forth. So we reserved that one. Okay, that's kind of the gamut of the feelings that we have. Now, this is what's going on, and I'm sure that you sense this as I did also. We move from a position of I do not belong to a position of I do belong. As we move in and out of new situations, there's a great deal of fear. Okay? Will I be accepted? This is the human condition. Will I be hurt? You know, we're not talking about physical hurt, but like animals, we kind of sort of protect ourselves psychologically and emotionally. Because I don't want to be hurt. This is a brand new position for me here at Hazelden. And it happens elsewhere. You move into a new neighborhood. Will I be accepted by my neighbors? You move into a new work job. Will I be accepted? A lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. And I don't want to be hurt by this situation. That's for sure. Now, in that process, as the dynamic is, as we move along here, growth is stifled, okay? We spend a great deal of our psychic energy defending ourselves, you see? So there's a lot of mistrust, there's a lot of gloom that settles in, and pessimism, and there's also what comes to the fore are our survival instincts, right? Our individual survival instincts. Now, whether you recognize it or not, and I'm sure you do now, this is what was happening then. Okay. Will I belong to this thing? Do I really belong here? Okay. That's part of that whole denial bag, too. But as we move along, and sometimes it's the hot seat that does it. Do we still have that in vogue here? For some people, okay. We get to a position where all of a sudden, hey, I do have a sense of belonging. Now, what brings that about? I don't have to tell you that. It's very simple formulas. You know, you don't have to have a PhD in psychology to understand this. What? Getting over them, that's right. But how is that done? Yeah, peers. Participation with peers, he says. Peers. Group. What happens? What are they doing? They're helping. How? Okay, by helping you get your feelings out. So what's happening practically and concretely is they're talking, all right? Talking to you, you're sharing, and they're listening, okay? It's a very simple formula. I've said before here that 80% of the recovery process that takes place at Hazelden is built on the 30 years that say the peers do it. It's second step. And if any of your counselors say that I'm responsible 80% of your recovery, you can tell them that in good language, he doesn't know what he's talking about, okay? So peers talk and listen and share.